One of the traits of a contemporary Unitarian service is that often you will be presented with a number of ideas from different traditions. We are not a church that says this is the truth of it. Rather, the search for truth is our sacrament. And when attempting to say something about our Unitarian community, I sometimes say that we look to prophets, to scientists, to poets, to rebels, and to dreamers for wisdom and inspiration, because we seek out wisdom from other faiths and philosophies. We listen, we endeavor to understand, and we may be moved to think or act differently. There is no creed or confession of faith required, and this is what marks us out among Christian denominations. I think a service leader or a minister is like a curator. We search for wisdom from many traditions, and we respect the spectrum of beliefs that are represented in our congregations. So today I bring science. I bring words and ideas from Christianity, from Taoism, from Buddhism, from poetry, philosophy, and atheism. And if you'll allow me, I will consider a papal encyclical which has drawn not only Christian but Jewish and Islamic praise and consideration. In my address this morning, I'm not going to outline the practical steps we must take to save the planet from climate change and the inevitable results that will emerge, because I suspect we all know what each of us must do. I am rather going to explore how we are an intimate part of creation. I am following on from what Alison has said already. I gained a new understanding putting this address together, and you might too. We are not visitors on planet Earth, and we have the capacity to understand that and to relearn what our ancestors understood. I remember a chat downstairs after a service one Sunday, some time ago, and the consensus was that the Earth will survive. It's us who are in trouble. Now, I think we are both in trouble. We are experiencing stronger storms, more rain, more heat. It's as if we are acting like a parasite on the green earth. We are consuming more, and we are told that consumption means greater wealth. We are told that in order to solve the world's ever-present poverty, hunger, and conflict, we must create wealth, which can only be achieved by more consumption. And the earth is responding. We are not visitors here. This is our home, our natural habitat. And we as a species have adapted to be very successful creatures. But our home is in trouble. And ironically, it needs our attention and care, or maybe more correctly, we need to stop or at least temper our consumption of Earth's resources. Buddhism tells us that human actions have consequences for the planet, and that a mindful, compassionate approach to living is essential for both personal well-being and environmental sustainability. I read a short poem by Sarah Teasdale during our sacred listening service a couple of weeks ago, and I think it deserves a second reading. There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a love fence wire. And no one will know of the war, no one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. So with us gone, will the rest of creation notice? But we too are part of this planet. We are made of the same stuff, the same stardust. And many of us might add, created out of love, with the DNA of the heart of the Creator, who some would call God. Karen Armstrong, you've already mentioned Karen. She's a wonderful author. I have her book here. In her book, Sacred Nature, she argues that the great religious and philosophical traditions have all nourished humanity, and they are the ones that developed between the years 900 and 200 before the Common Era, all pre-Christian. And these great traditions are Confucianism and Taoism in China, Hinduism and Buddhism in India, monotheism in Israel, and rationalism in Greece. That's Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. Now, each of these traditions pioneered a new kind of spirituality. These spiritualities, despite their differences, all shared a common ethos and, crucially, a similar understanding of humanity's relationship with the natural world. Armstrong suggests that we have never wholly surpassed the profound insights of this time. It's not a question of believing religious doctrine. It's about incorporating into our lives insights and practices that will not only help us to meet today's serious challenges, but also change our hearts and our minds. So what about that sacred thread that connects us all? The Qi, the Confucian understanding of creation, best described as a trinity, if you allow me to be a Trinitarian for a moment. So together, heaven, earth, and humanity form a continuum. It is organic, it is holistic, and it is dynamic. Humanity and the cosmos are one. Now I'm back to being Unitarian. Tu Weiming is a contemporary Confucian scholar, and he would suggest that there is no division between human beings and the cosmos because the two share the same reality. There's a 4th century text from the Taoist tradition which attempts to describe it. The vital essence of all things, it is this that brings them to life. It generates the 5 grains below and becomes the constellated stars above. And when flowing amid the heavens and the earth, we call it ghostly and numinous. When stored within the chests of human beings, we call them sages. So this vital essence is the Qing, the fundamental source and vitality. In Christianity, in Judaism or Islam, we might call this God or the Creator. Aristotle would have called it the unmoved mover, the ultimate explanation for motion and change in the universe. Now, those 5 grains below are a symbol of sustenance and earthly life. The Qing is seen as the source of this nourishment, supporting all life on earth. And then the constellated stars above. The Qing is not limited to the earthly realm, but also extends to the celestial. So this describes the Qing as the universal force that permeates all existence, from the smallest cells to the largest stars, and it is the source of all life and vitality. Now, nowhere in this arrangement is the human being the dominant creature. When Confucius declared, "Do not impose on others what you yourself do not desire," he suggested that this includes all that is in nature. Why? Because we share the same vital force. Now I wonder, is this how Jesus understood it when he spoke those words? The Unitarian Universalists, our cousins in religion across the pond, have as one of their key principles interdependence. They say, we honor the interdependent web of all existence and acknowledge our place in it. We covenant to protect the earth and all beings from exploitation. We will create and nurture sustainable relationships of care and respect, mutuality and justice. So with that in mind, I'd like now to look at Pope Francis's contribution to the question of our environmental crisis. Laudato si, it is Latin for praise be to you. It's his encyclical from 2015, 10 years ago. An encyclical is a public letter from a pope developing Catholic thought on a topic. Now, this letter focuses on care for the environment and all people, as well as broader questions of the relationship between God, humans, and the earth. There is a lot in Laudato Si that is commendable. Now, it's not just a treatise of Catholic doctrine. It outlines in very easy, accessible chapters all the key sociological and scientific issues relating to our crisis. So climate change, biodiversity, water pollution, global inequality, the weak responses from governments, the role of technology, the role of politics, economics, and education. Now, it does a great deal of theology, and I suggest that it echoes much of what I have spoken about, that sacred thread. Our friends, the Unitarian Universalists, issued a statement after it was published. We wholeheartedly agree with the Pope's statement that we need to strengthen the conviction that we are one single human family. There are no frontiers or barriers, political or social, behind which we can hide. They say that the interconnectedness of all life calls for honesty to question certain models of development, production, and consumption. Now, Laudato Si gives some attention to the role of faith, and it assumes particular beliefs about God and the Christian scriptures. It is, after all, a papal encyclical. For me, in this context, I understand faith as a conviction without certainty, an acceptance of that which I do not understand, but have an innate sense that there is an underlying reality in creation that is greater than I. Now, you may not share my understanding, but let me quote him for a moment. The gaze of science, he says, benefits from faith. Faith calls us to an ever-widening path of harmony and understanding. Faith encourages the scientist to remain constantly open to reality in all its inexhaustible richness. Faith awakens the critical sense by preventing research from being satisfied by its own formulae and helps us to realize that nature is always greater. Now, you may say, I do not believe there is this intelligent God behind creation. I do not share this faith that you speak of. Well, let me rephrase and suggest that the created world requires our care, empathy, but creation requires me to feel it, to experience it. An understanding creation and the science it reveals to us is not merely an intellectual exercise. There are two characters from the 12th century. They would be considered early Christian mystics. Hugh St. Victor and his pupil, Richard St. Victor. And they echo what was held centuries before them and not dissimilar to our friend Confucius. They suggested we use what they called three sets of eyes. There we are, Trinitarian once more. Firstly, the bodily eyes. I look and I see what is right in front of me. Second, the eye of reason with which we think about what we see. And then thirdly, there are the eyes of true understanding that enable us through contemplation to penetrate deeper to what breathes fire into the reality we behold. Now, whether theist, atheist, agnostic, or none of the above, this third eye enables us to see something wondrous, something beautiful, and something that might even be mysterious. Now, of all of the early Christian mystics, My favorite is Meister Eckhart. Now, just to say that Eckhart and the two Saint Victors were all accused of heresy in their own time, so they're welcome here. So Meister Eckhart viewed creation as an ongoing dynamic process, not a singular event in the past. That's what got him into trouble. He believed God is continually creating and holding all things in being. For Eckhart, creation is an expression of the divine, a kind of divinity itself, with all creatures acting as expressions, or as he says, books about God. He emphasized that God is both immanent within creation and transcendent, present yet always beyond human comprehension. Now, it sounds very, very much like Muslim scholars, which I'll talk about in a second. Now, Pope Francis would not have drawn, like us, upon the wisdom of these other great faiths and philosophies I mentioned, and he certainly wouldn't have drawn on Eckhart and the Saint Victors. I would suggest that while he doesn't directly cite non-Christian faiths and philosophies, he subtly incorporates some of the wisdom I've referenced, particularly regarding the interconnectedness of all things. He says, "Nothing in this world is indifferent to us." And referring to the creation accounts in Genesis, he suggests the text, and I quote, "suggests that human life is grounded in three fundamental and closely intertwined relationships, with God, with our neighbor, and with the earth itself." Interestingly, he describes the creation stories as symbolic, narrative, not history. He says that the notion that humanity would have dominion over the earth is not a correct interpretation of the Bible. Although he says it is true that we Christians have at times incorrectly interpreted the scriptures, nowadays we must forcefully reject the notion that our being created in God's image gives us the right to have dominion over the earth. Now, I lifted my head from the text and I pondered that sentence. When Genesis tells us to fill the earth and conquer it, that humans are given dominion over the earth, how might I interpret that differently or better? Now, I found something of an answer in Karen Armstrong's Sacred Nature. She says, "The Hebrew Bible does not focus on the sanctity of nature. The people of Israel experienced the divine in human events. Whereas in Islam, the natural world is the breath of God, and everything in it is an expression of the divine sigh." We hear Confucianism in there. Now, Laudato Si has served as a catalyst for broader conversations about environmental ethics, interfaith cooperation, and the shared responsibility of humanity in caring for our planet. Both Jewish and Islamic scholars welcomed Laudato Si. Rashid Omar pointed to the Quran in chapter 55, and in the Quran it is written, "God has raised the cosmos and set up for all things the balance. So do not transgress the balance. Weigh therefore your deeds with justice and cause no loss in the balance." And Omar calls upon Muslim scholars to engage with the text in order to build broad solidarity with meaningful global commitments. Then a number of leading American rabbis agreed that Jews should address the climate crisis in the nearest way analogous to an encyclical, by the issuing of a rabbinic letter. Why, they asked each other? Well, for three reasons, lots of threes today. Firstly, to bring unique Jewish wisdom to the worldwide efforts to heal the world from climate disruption. Secondly, to remind the Jewish community itself that practical wisdom about the relationships between human beings and the earth is encoded in the Torah. And thirdly, to connect with younger Jews who are deeply concerned about the damaged world and their children may inherit. So, in conclusion, what might I do now? Perhaps I will begin by being wordless as I begin again to encounter the natural world and connect to the oneness of creation. And I don't need to go to some far-flung mountaintop or deep forest miles from civilization to encounter the natural world. We could go to Alison's garden. And in the words of the Tao Te Ching, without stirring abroad, one can know the whole world. Without looking out of the window, one can see the way to heaven. The further one goes, the less one knows. Therefore, the sage knows without having to stir, identifies without having to see, and accomplishes without having to ask. There is a prayer I like to bring to our services, and it features the words, "Teach us to retain our conviction that what we do makes a difference, that even our smallest act can contribute to the good of a greater whole." So let us all help each other to find those small or big acts. Much wisdom is already here. So let us share that wisdom, and together we might protect our planet Earth for all of creation, both present and future. Amen.